If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
During this difficult time, we want to make it as easy as possible for our readers to get their copy of BBC History Magazine or BBC History Revealed. So for the next few months, we'll deliver your favourite magazine direct to your door with no delivery charge. From today, you can save up to 70% off the shop price and subscribe from just £9.99. That's just £1.66 per issue. There's never been a better time to get your favourite history magazine delivered direct to your home. To take advantage of this unmissable offer, please visit buysubscriptions.com/History Extra and choose your magazine. Don't forget, all of our magazines are also available digitally on your mobile or tablet device. Visit buysubscriptions.com/History Extra for more information. We look forward to welcoming you. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. As I'm sure you're aware, the news is currently dominated by the global spread of coronavirus. And a lot of the conversation has revolved around the lasting impact of COVID-19 and how it could reshape our societies. To draw a historical parallel, today's podcast looks at the widespread consequences of another disease, the Black Death. Our guest is Jane Whittle, a professor at the University of Exeter who studied the economic and social impact of the Black Death in medieval England. Our content director, David Musgrove, spoke to her to find out more.
I'm joined today by Professor Jane Whittle, who Jane Whittle is a historian of late medieval and early modern England at the University of Exeter. She's written an interesting guest blog on the Early Modern Society and Culture blog website at manyheadedmonster.wordpress.com about the government's response to the Black Death. And the Black Death, of course, was a pandemic in the mid-14th century that killed millions across Europe and Asia and is estimated to have caused the deaths of half the population of England, which is a phenomenal and terrifying number. What we're going to talk about today is the societal and economic changes that the Black Death caused. But first, Jane, I suppose we need a bit of context. So would it be possible for you to sketch out the nature of society that existed in England? And we are talking about England here, I think, specifically at the time the plague struck.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it was a rural society. And we'd probably describe it as a peasant society. So most people were farming small plots of land, often very small, so barely enough to survive on. It was a feudal society. So these peasants were paying rent to manorial lords who had political power and sat in parliament, many of them. So the peasants supported the class of manorial lords by paying rent to them in various forms.
And that society had been reasonably static for a few generations before we get to the Black Death?
So we know quite a lot about the 100 years before we get to Black Death. So we have a lot of documents that tell us about rural society. And from that, it was stable in the sense it's had the same type of institutional structures, but people lived in villages. The land was owned by manorial lords, and everything was organised around this kind of manorial structure. So tenants not only paid rent, but many of them were unfree and actually belonged to manorial lords, so they were part of the property. There was change in that period. So we know population was growing, and that was putting pressure on the land and increasing poverty. And we know that there was, for instance, quite severe famine in the early 14th century, 1315, and people were really struggling to survive. And it's estimated the mortality, for instance, in that famine might have been about 15%. So it was already a society that was kind of under pressure and perhaps not functioning as well as it might be.
Okay. And then we get this major event that happens in the mid 14th century, and just quoting back from the blog that I mentioned in my introduction, you made an interesting point, which is, I'm just going to read it out for the benefit of the listeners: unprecedented episodes of disease, such as the current outbreak of COVID-19, are moments of fluidity when parts of existing societies are laid bare as not fit for purpose. So I'm wondering, were there areas of society and economy that were not fit for purpose in 1347-48 when the Black Death struck?
The interesting thing about Black Death is that things didn't collapse straight away. So although the mortality was extraordinarily high, it's perhaps the more surprising thing is things did actually carry on as normal. So peasants still worked the land and they still paid rent to the lords, and the lords still sat in parliament and passed laws, and the king still ruled over them and was still carrying on kind of fighting wars and so on. So things didn't change straight away at all. But what we see is that in 1349, which is about a year and a half after the plague had first struck England, we have this law passed called the Ordinance of Labourers, which complains that people are not willing to work for the same wages that they used to work for. And it enacts various measures to basically force people to work so that manorial lords can carry on in the same economic position that they were before.
And this was this a significant intervention by the government? And I suppose we should probably clarify what we mean by government here. What was the nature of government in the mid 14th century?
So there was the king and his immediate advisors or council, and then there was parliament, which was made up of a gathering of the lords and then a gathering of the commons. The commons were not as we would think of the House of Commons today. So the commons were gentry, so gentlemen, and also wealthy townspeople. And we're talking quite a small group of people as well, like, about 200 people in the commons. It's not just the king making these decisions. He would consult with parliament.
But this isn't a representative democracy in any way. They're not looking out for necessarily the interests of the wider population.
No, and it's interesting in that in the early 14th century, which was when the commons started meeting, but let's call them a House of Commons, although they weren't actually known as that at the time. They started meeting regularly. And before the Black Death, they seemed quite happy to see themselves as representing the common people and standing up against the king, who wanted higher taxes and also was confiscating food and materials to fight wars, which clearly the population were very unhappy about. So in that period, we see Parliament actually, to some extent, sticking up for the interests of ordinary people. But with the Black Death, we see a quite noticeable change in that they start to see themselves as a group of employers who have common economic interests, which are actually the opposite of much of the population, who are people who are working for wages. So we see a new sort of type of social divide emerge and is reflected in what Parliament is doing.
So that takes us back into the Ordinance of Labourers that you talked about earlier. So that was this was a mechanism that was designed to address the labour shortage that was happening because of the high mortality that people were seeing on the ground.
Yeah, and I think the really interesting thing about the Ordinance of Labourers is we might expect that that the government would have been more concerned about serfdom. So serfdom is seen as the crucial structure in feudal society that keeps ordinary peasants in their place, if you like.
Perhaps you could just explain what serfdom is for us.
Yeah, so in the period we're talking about, perhaps about half of the tenants were unfree. So that meant that they were given a certain social status we would call it serfdom today. They didn't use that term then, but it's basically serfdom. And that meant that they couldn't own property. Everything they had belonged to their manorial lord. They weren't meant to leave the village where they lived. And they had to work the land and pay rent to the lord. So it wasn't a matter of choice. They had that position in society, and it was an inherited position. If we imagine that the king and people in parliament were concerned about social order, we might imagine that they would turn to serfdom and say, well, let's strengthen serfdom and make sure that these people stay in their place. But that wasn't what they did. Instead, they legislated about wage labour.
So they moved away from the existing system and decided that the system they needed to have instead was one whereby people were paid for the work they were done.
Yeah, and I mean, clearly they weren't making up the idea of wage labour. Wage labour was very common before the Black Death, but it existed alongside serfdom. And so manorial lords had large amounts of land. And some of that they rented out to tenants, but some they kept for themselves and managed directly. And on that land, which was known as domain land, in some places it was worked by unfree tenants as part of serfdom. So the unfree tenants performed labour services. But mostly by the mid-14th century, it was worked by wage labour, because it had been realised that wage labour was much more efficient and flexible, and the workers were better motivated. So what we see with the Ordinance of Labourers is that in this moment of crisis, rather than the government seeking to strengthen the institution of serfdom, they don't think of doing that. They think, no, the problem is the problem of wage labour, and we have to make sure we have a good supply of wage labour and that people are willing to work for us.
So, and this was driven directly by the impact of the Black Death, presumably.
Yeah, so the Ordinance of Labourers, which was passed in 1349, it starts... its first few lines are saying, because so many people have died, we can't get the workers we need, workers are more, they want to beg in idleness, it says, rather than labour to get their living. So they really see that this problem of labour shortage is caused by the outbreak of disease. They're very clear about that. And their solution to it, rather than, for instance, raising wages or treating their workers better, the solution is to force people to work and to set wages at the pre-plague levels.
Sure. And so the measures that they put in place, they were not, what would you say, they weren't progressive or really in the interest of the labourers, were they?
No, definitely not. And so they're saying that anybody who's between, well, actually they don't give a bottom age, but they say anyone who's younger than 60 and who doesn't have land or a craft with which to occupy themselves, anyone in that category must work. And if they don't offer themselves to work, they'll be forced to work. Once they're within a contract of work, then they must not leave that place of work before the end of the agreed term. And it also fixed the level of wages.
So, I mean, that doesn't sound great for the labourers, does it? So was that better or worse than serfdom for the people on the receiving end of it?
I think it's probably better than serfdom. It's not inherited. It's people would get paid, and it's accepted that people might move between employers, between contracts. Within the wage-labour relationship, it's trying to say that this isn't going to be a relationship, a contractual relationship between equals. If you don't have property, then you have a duty to work and to work on the terms that are laid down in the legislation.
So what was the reaction amongst the peasantry to this then? Was there uproar about it, or was it just that this is what happens and we have to get on with it?
Well, I think the interesting thing is we have to think about who's employing labour and who's providing it. So if you were a relatively wealthy peasant, you're probably employing labour. So you might actually support this legislation. If you were poorer and you didn't have enough land to support yourself, then you're on the receiving end. So it's something that's going to kind of split communities. So it's not kind of that the peasantry as a whole would be against it. The poorer parts of the peasantry and those without land were on the receiving end of it. The wealthier peasantry actually helped to enforce these laws.
So how does this tie in with the narrative that I think probably quite a few people would think about from the aftermath of the Black Death, that the position of the labourer must surely have been strengthened by dint of the fact that there were less people around, so the employers, the people who needed the work done, would have to be nicer to the people who were going to do the work?
Yeah, well, I mean, these laws set out how they wanted it to be. It's quite another thing to actually enforce the laws. And we can see that there is pressure to pay higher wages. At the same time, the laws are unusually, in particularly in Eastern England, where there was a lot of wage labour, they are actually enforced quite rigorously. And one of the measures of the laws was that people were fined for taking high wages, and the amount they were fined could then be used by that community to help pay taxes. So the community had a sort of incentive to fine people for receiving high wages. But we do see economic change, and it's clear that there is a pressure for higher wages. But at the same time, there is quite a lot of action taken to try and keep wages down as well.
And what about this sense of social mobility? Well, not social mobility, actual mobility of people leaving where they lived or were born and going elsewhere to seek work. How does that tie into this story?
Yeah, well, there must have been a lot of that going on. So we painted a picture of before the plague where, you know, a lot of people were tied to one place by serfdom, and there was a real shortage of land. after the Black Death, land was easier to acquire and there was a big incentive to move. If you moved away from the place that you belonged to, you might actually manage to become a free person rather than unfree. If you weren't a serf, you could move anyway, seeking better economic opportunities. So I think part of what the laws are doing, that they're kind of expressing a real shock on the part of the ruling class and the employing class, that ordinary people are showing quite a lot of initiative to try and improve their lot. And this is causing a lot of problems for those who want to employ them, who are used to being able to employ large numbers of people on very low wages in order to farm their land or build their houses or whatever. Yeah, it is in that sense a period where you can see that change is coming to an extent, but the ruling class are really pushing against those changes.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
There was this strong understanding, which is very clear from the legislation, that people had a duty to work. And that unemployment was not just, I mean, we might think it's not desirable to be unemployed, but they thought it was morally wrong not to work. And therefore, everybody had the duty to work.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
It seems like quite a fast response from the government, really. When we think about the fact that the Black Death only really arrived, what did you say, 18 months before the before the ordinance was instituted, that you kind of get the sense, or maybe this is just me being ignorant, but you kind of get the sense that medieval government would be fairly slow to move in that sort of thing. Set me straight. But how were they able to act so quickly?
No, I think that is one of the remarkable things about it, that, you know, the plague was still kind of virulent at the point when they passed this law. And this is what they're thinking about. This is what they're most concerned about. So I think that is actually very striking. it takes a couple of years before Parliament actually meets. So Parliament doesn't meet until 1351. And then as soon as they meet, one of the first things they do is take these the ordinance of 1348, which is basically a kind of royal proclamation, and they turn it into a statute supported by Parliament. And the interesting thing about Parliament then and for the rest of the 14th century, really, is that it's pushing the king to make this legislation even more severe, to have increasing controls on working people, rather than it being kind of the king that's pushing it. So it definitely seems to be coming from quite a large group of people who are people who would employ a lot of labour, who really see this as one of the most pressing issues of government in this period.
So the governmental response is basically broadly economic here, isn't it? Or at least the way you've described it. Was there no element of something more akin to looking to help people or resolve the obvious medical emergency, or would they just think there was nothing they could do about it other than resort to prayer, which was being dealt with by the church anyway?
Yes, so there's nothing in terms of a kind of medical response. No, so that's, I mean, really very different from the situation we find ourselves in at the moment. Yeah.
Is from your research, is there anything was the medieval economy and society in any way prepared for a global pandemic in the 14th century? Was how ready were they for this sort of thing, if at all?
I think not at all. So I don't think it's something that people would have expected. But in terms of sort of how people dealt with it, I think because most people kind of lived on the land and farming was the main way of making a living, you know, I think a lot of the problems we're having nowadays are about accessing food, for instance. For them, that wasn't the issue. I think the issue was really there was no systematic medical care, no real understanding of how disease was spread. And so there was no kind of, social or medical response in that sense.
But the government, the king and his entourage must have been very aware of the fact that this was a significant problem. So how were they finding that out? Was it because their leading tenants were coming to them saying, we've got this problem with serfdom and a lack of workers, or were there reports coming in that were telling them about the catastrophe that was unfolding?
Well, the king is himself a lord, so he has his own tenants and his own workers, so he would have known what was going on, the people in the elite, they weren't geographically removed from people of the lower orders. They were surrounded by them wherever they were. So I think, there's no difficulty in finding out what's going on. You can see what's going on around you. Amongst them, the kind of king and council would have had knowledge about what was going on in various different parts of the country. So I think in that sense that they would have been very well aware what was happening.
So how does the Peasants' Revolt fit into this story? That was obviously in 1381, a topic that many people have studied at school and which must have led on in some way from what happened in the Black Death.
Yeah, certainly. So we can see 1381 as an expression of all these built-up frustrations with the ordinary population. And it's interesting because if you look at the demands of the rebels, they both, on the one hand, they demand an end to serfdom. So serfdom hadn't disappeared. It might have been weakened, but it hasn't disappeared. And it's clear that people want it to end because they bothered to state that in their demands. But it was also a rebellion against the labour laws. So there was a lot of action against the justices who enforced the laws. And also the burning of legal documents in an attempt to kind of erase them from the system. So I think we could see 1381 as an expression of popular feeling. And it's interesting that for ordinary people, both serfdom and the labour laws are key issues, really.
Okay, so what's the long term consequences of what happened then with the with these acts to move to a wage labour economy?
Yeah, well, I think for me, one of the really interesting things about 1349, so this labour legislation was created in this moment of crisis, but it lives on, and the basic measures that it put in place stay as part of a kind of active legislation within the country until the early 19th century. That's an awful long time. They are actually reenacted in the 16th century in 1563. And some historians have seen that as a kind of entirely new piece of legislation. But I think we now have evidence that the measures which were enacted in the 14th century carried on being enforced in the 15th century and in the mid 16th century. And then the 1563 Act was just a reenactment of many of the measures and elaborating other parts of them. And then that Act carries on being enforced in the 17th and the 18th century. So I think that's really remarkable that it has that long life, despite the fact it emerged from a moment of crisis.
You've taken us up to the 19th century. So a big change then. So the consequences of the Black Death, basically they spread out for a good 600 years from when the event happened.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure it's the consequences of the Black Death, but it was a realisation that the economy was no longer based on serfdom. It was based on wage labour. And that wage labour economy carried on existing in roughly the same form until the late 18th, early 19th century, when it's really transformed by industrialisation. So I think it's kind of telling us that that the economy had entered a new phase. But I think another interesting thing about it is that historians have, I guess, thought about it. Okay, so there was the end of serfdom, and then we had free wage labour, where people could negotiate contracts, and we think of it as a kind of free market economy. But I think that the existence of the labour laws reminds us that people at the time did not understand it in that way. There was this strong understanding, which is very clear from the legislation, that people had a duty to work, and that unemployment was not just, I mean, we might think it's not desirable to be unemployed, but they thought it was morally wrong not to work, and therefore everybody had the duty to work, and they carried on legislating wage levels. But whereas nowadays we legislate for minimum wages, they legislated for maximum wages, so you were not allowed to earn more than a certain amount. So these principles that people had a duty to work, that wages were controlled, and that various aspects of a contract were controlled so that people couldn't break contracts. These principles carried on being in place from the mid-14th century through to the late 18th century, and they remained on the statute books until the early 19th century.
So clearly that's very significant. I wonder, before we wrap up and start thinking about the implications of what might be happening to us today with COVID-19, did these laws impact more onerously on men than women? What was the gender situation here? Because, you know, I've read quite a lot in the past about the fact that the Black Death was in some ways good for women. I don't know if that's a view that that you have any take any credence to.
I think one of the remarkable things about the laws is they very clear that they apply to women as well as men. So if you needed an indication that in the past it was expected that women would work and earn their own living, these laws are a very clear indication of that. So the idea that everybody under the age of 60 had to work, it specifies men and women. But then when you look at the wages that are legislated, they're always set at a lower level for women than they are for men. So it's not like gender equality, but women certainly had a duty to work and to work for wages.
Okay. So that's the Black Death. Even in the worst case scenarios that were being predicted, the COVID-19 pandemic isn't going to get anywhere near the levels of mortality that that they horrendously experienced in the 14th century. So I suppose I'm not asking you to compare the two, but what's your view on how far what's going on now might lead to societal changes? And if so, what, where, how, when?
Yeah, well, you know, it's not possible to foretell the future, but it got me thinking about how in kind of extraordinary moments, be they caused by disease or perhaps more commonly by war, that governments will enact new measures or put new measures in place. And that kind of suggests that there's a certain fluidity in these moments that things that were taken for granted beforehand are questioned. And because society faces an unprecedented situation, that often they start thinking differently about how problems might be solved. So, yeah, from my point of view, I wonder if the situation we're currently in might lead to government and society at large thinking differently about how we might solve some of the problems we face at the moment.
And how do you think that might happen? You've talked about the possibility of the universal basic income, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you just think about the world of work, it's clear that in the last 20, 30 years, the nature of work has been changing, the nature of paid work. So we've had things like the gig economy emerging, zero-hour contracts, much more fluid job markets. So kind of the idea of having a lifelong career is receding. And it's not very clear that government policy or wider social attitudes have kind of kept up with these changes. And at the same time, systems of welfare are strongly connected to the way we work. And it's clear that at the moment, very many people who work hard, work full time, but don't earn enough to support their families. So, and on the horizon, we have prospect of more automation of work, leading to more difficulties for people finding work. So, yeah, the idea of universal basic income is a fundamentally different way of approaching all these issues. And rather than having a complex, means-tested welfare system that compensates for people who can't earn enough or can't find a job, universal basic income says, well, we're all part of the same society. We need to support each other. Here is a basic amount to allow you to survive. If you earn a lot of money, then you can be taxed and that will take that money back to the government. I think a system like that might be a more effective way of dealing with the problems we face in the modern world of work. And it's also an approach that might have been a useful way of sorting out the issues we have right now of how people are actually going to support themselves if, work isn't happening because we're all self-isolating ourselves in order to counteract spread of disease.
That was Professor Jane Whittle of the University of Exeter. You can read plenty more about the Black Death and medieval history more generally on our website, historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Friday when Tom Ellis will be discussing the mission to rescue Apollo 13.